blue billionaires. And so it was that during the aughts, the media made its great discovery. A substantial number of rich people were, in fact, pretty liberal. There were precedents for this, of course. Think of the many WASP Brahmins over the years who have been interested in protecting endangered species. But what was happening now was different. Not only were there said to be many more rich liberals than in the past, but they were separated from rich conservatives by a rift greater than personal taste. The divide between rich liberals and rich conservatives was supposed to be something essential, something engraved in the very structure of our society, and, needless to say, something upon which you could safely build the Democratic Party. Some saw the split between the two factions of the wealthy in quasi-moral terms. For Daniel Gross, writing in the year 2000, it all came down to arrogant capital versus humble capital, meaning that selfish and stuck-up investment bankers were Republicans, while modest and unpretentious ones were Democrats. For the journalist David Callahan, it was, among other things, a matter of the dirty rich versus the clean rich, meaning that industrialists who polluted were conservatives, while those who purchased carbon offsets were liberals. Every now and then, one of these rich liberals was moved to write a manifesto handing down his own personal wisdom on the matter. John Sperling, the billionaire behind the for-profit University of Phoenix, made a notable splash in 2004 when he published a work of political theory called The Great Divide, Retro versus Metro America. Like every other liberal class reformer to take up the pencil over the preceding 30 years, the billionaire Sperling advised Democrats to give up immediately on the class-based politics of the New Deal. What the party needed to adopt instead was an industry-based approach. Instead of understanding voters in terms of their place in the social hierarchy, in other words, the way to think about them was by what industry dominated their state or region. Democrats had to understand that places where people embraced economic modernity and worked in manufacturing, finance, insurance, and services in general were now what made up the liberal base. Places where extraction industries dominated, on the other hand, were the heart of red state backwardness, closed to science and entrepreneurship, and given, thanks to their weird fundamentalist religions, to racism and low taxes. So spake the liberal billionaire. The country had polarized itself into two nations, he declared, two incompatible cultural economic systems. One of these Americas, the retro one, was rooted in the past. The other America, which Sperling dubbed Metro, was modern and focused on the future. The obviously superior Metro America consisted of vibrant cities where people appreciated fine things like ballet and believed in rational discourse and birth control. Retro America, however, was a place of ugly pursuits like oil and farming, a land of white supremacy where people have chosen irrationality along with lowbrow religions in which pudgy men bellow feral slogans at giant rallies. Another failing of the retro areas, the billionaire charged, was that they were hostile to the spirit of enterprise, suffering from a dearth of scientists, inventors, innovators, entrepreneurs, and captains of industry, the people who build modern economies. Those fine people were only to be found in the metro regions, places where thrived admirable institutions like the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which, Sperling wanted you to know, owned a highly creative Frank Gehry building, under whose wildly zigzagging roof transpired all manner of juicy, research-focused collaboration. The marks of the master class. Creative buildings, creative innovation, creativity in general, who doesn't love these things? Creativity is self-evidently good. It is beyond controversy. And in the years of the last decade, it also began to seem like the defining virtue of liberalism, the quality that brought together all its different constituencies among the affluent. During the aughts, Democratic officials and administrators across the country were wowed by the idea that conspicuous public counterculture was a thing to be encouraged because it appealed to members of the professional managerial class. Making such people feel welcome, in turn, was the way to achieve prosperity, as we could clearly see from successful cities like Austin and San Francisco. This idea, which raged through the Bush years and which rages still, was given memorable expression by a professor of economic development named Richard Florida, specifically in his 2002 bestseller, The Rise of the Creative Class. Yes, the creative class. We've heard several flattering ways of describing the professional cohort, and now we come to the most obsequious designation of them all. According to Richard Florida, creatives were the dominant class in America, because the thing they controlled, creativity, had become the decisive source of competitive advantage. New technologies, new industries, new wealth, and all other good economic things flow from it. In Florida's reasoning, this creative class included traditional artists and intellectuals, but the creatives who really mattered were people who worked in tech, people who worked in offices, people with advanced degrees. The same people, as it happened, with whom Democrats had been infatuated since the days of McGovern, only with one new detail. Professionals were now described as the class that creates, like farmers were in the imagination of Thomas Jefferson, or like the proletariat was in the dreams of the 1930s. Cities and regions across the country heeded the guru's advice and swung immediately into the work of ingratiating themselves with the creative class. The hard-bitten state of Michigan launched a Cool Cities initiative, which, in the words of the state's governor, established numerous local commissions on cool that are uncorking the bottle of creativity. Dayton, Ohio, decided it needed a film festival as well as a Dayton Creative Incubator, a performance hall called C-Space, and an art exhibit called Creative Soul of Dayton. Tampa, Florida, appointed what USA Today called a manager of creative industries, and Creative Tampa Bay dedicated itself to synergizing the community's assets to cultivate an environment that encourages innovation, expands the economy, and is a magnet for creative people, as its website used to say. The ones who ingratiated the most were Democrats, who saw in the creative class strategy a way to revitalize struggling cities that were left behind when manufacturing departed for other climes. The many, many bike paths that were built in hopes that professionals would show up and ride on them, by and large, those were built by Democrats. All those art districts and street fairs, Democrats. Indeed, Republicans were excluded from competing for the favor of the new dominant class almost by definition, since one of Richard Florida's requirements was that cities perform well on what he called the gay index. Sure, those vulgar Republicans could offer crass inducements like low taxes, but in the age of creativity, it was supposed to be your town's theatrical performances and its carefully handmade cupcakes that truly opened the door to prosperity. Prosperity was a laudable goal, of course, and supporting culture was a laudable means, but that doesn't mean the one is necessarily connected to the other. In fact, the creative class theory was based on a colossal blurring of cause and effect. An art scene isn't something that springs up before a city becomes affluent. Generally speaking, it follows the money. This didn't stop political officials all over the country from adopting the creative class strategy, however. In the absence of any concrete development policies, it must have seemed like a quick and affordable way to tackle civic decline. Florida himself would later back away from certain aspects of his original theory, admitting that we can't stop the decline of some places and that we would be foolish to try. I bring all this up not because I want to refute it. It refutes itself. but because its eager adoption by liberal politicians tells us something important about the modern Democratic Party and its attitudes toward equality. In its quest for prosperity, the Party of the People declared itself wholeheartedly in favor of a social theory that forthrightly exalted the rich, the all-powerful creative class. For many cities and states, this was the economic strategy. This was what our leaders came up with to revive the urban wastelands and restore the deindustrialized zones. The democratic idea was no longer to confront privilege, but to flatter privilege, to sing the praises of our tasteful new master class. True, this was all done with an eye toward rebuilding the crumbling cities where the rest of us lived and worked, but the consequences of all this creative class bootlicking will take a long time to wear off. Working by then as a consultant to governments around the country, Florida himself ventured into politics in 2004 when he took to the pages of Washington Monthly to denounce the Republican Party and the science-doubting administration of George W. Bush as enemies of capitalism, or of modern creative capitalism, anyway. The red states the Republicans represented were lands of economic backwardness, according to Florida, while Democratic areas, with their tolerance and love of learning, were zones of thrusting modernity. During the great years of the new economy, Florida reminisced, these liberal-led places became hothouses of innovation, the modern-day equivalents of Renaissance city-states, where scientists, artists, designers, engineers, financiers, marketers, and sundry entrepreneurs fed off each other's knowledge, energy, and capital to make new products, new services, and whole new industries. Cutting-edge entertainment in Southern California, new financial instruments in New York, computer products in Northern California and Austin, satellites and telecommunications in Washington, D.C., software and innovative retail in Seattle, biotechnology in Boston. Let us be clear about the political views Florida was expounding here. The problem with, say, George W. Bush's administration was not that it favored the rich. It was that it favored the wrong rich, the old economy rich. Similarly, the problem with the intense Republican partisanship of those years was that it turned a deaf ear to the voices of the country's most important and creative industries, such as Wall Street and Silicon Valley, since such places chose Democrats as a matter of course. Richard Florida wept for unfairly ignored industries, but he expressed little sympathy for the working people whose issues were now ignored by both parties. In fact, he sometimes seemed to regard these people as part of the problem. In the summer of 2008, Florida told a British newspaper that the creative class anticipates the future, while the working class tends to seek protection from it. The only lesson we really needed to learn from the working class experience was how they pulled off their political triumph in the 1930s, which Florida thought the creative class now needed to replicate. Just as Franklin Delano Roosevelt forged a new majority on the swelling ranks of blue-collar workers, so must the party that hopes to win this presidential election earn the enthusiastic support of today's ascending economic and political force. The creative class. Florida spoke those words in June of 2008. The collapse of the ultra-creative Lehman Brothers investment bank came a scant 3 months later, and I would like to be able to say that these dreams of prosperity through tastefulness followed, right down the drain, with the hedge funds and the subprime lenders of the world. After all, one of the greatest deeds of the creative class was financial innovation. Meaning, among other things, the poisoned mortgage-backed securities that brought the global economy so close to death. But the ideas I have described in this chapter did not suffer the same fate. As with free trade and welfare reform, there seems to be no refutation that can dissuade their supporters. Indeed, with the election of the young and innovative challenger, Barack Obama, they got a second wind. Under his administration, they became more vigorous than ever. And with their flourishing, our modern Democrats wandered ever further from their egalitarian traditions.